Hello, my name is Christine Owen, and I'm pleased to welcome to the Freemail Shipping News, Alice Cummins. Alice is not only a dance artist with a long history of performance and teaching, both here and in the Eastern States, as we say in WA, and overseas, but she's also an old friend who recently returned to live in WA. Welcome, Alice.
Thank you, Christine.
Nice to see you. Alice, can we start right here in Fremantle? What does Fremantle bring to mind for you now you're back here and walking its streets again?
And it's a Saturday today, so it brings up Saturday mornings, taking my kids down to Papa Luigi's for the weekly ice cream, the library, and time zone. I spent probably 7 years living in Fremantle, something like that. I was studying at WAPA, and then I was teaching at WAPA and at different high schools and various institutions. My kids were at school in Frio. And I guess Fremantle for me is a place where I go to the cinema, visit friends, have meals, and also...
And you've been rehearsing here in North
Fremantle. And I've been
rehearsing
in the North Fremantle Community Hall, which is beginning to feel like I'm my personal studio, which is... And I found the people at the Fremantle Council, the particular person I've been dealing with, has been incredibly supportive and helpful.
Oh, fantastic.
And I've also taught there as well. One of my nationwide courses, so that's been...
And I was fortunate enough to see you rehearse, so it's a lovely round space too, and that was a wonderful experience for me. So you haven't always been a dance artist, or as some people say, a contemporary dancer. You started in ballet. Can you talk about early days? Because I have 3 granddaughters who are now besotted with ballet, and it's where many girls start.
Yes.
You want to comment on that?
Well,
on your experience?
Being a child of the 50s, I had a mother who was creative, probably bohemian, and I mean, I'd say she was a bohemian, and she had a great interest in the arts and literature, and she took me to the Russian Ballet when they came, it wasn't so much the Royal Ballet, but Fontaine came, and so I was taken to
fantastic.
Those treats. And
how old ballet could you have been, do you think?
I was seven. I was seven when my mother took me to Kira Buslov, and I stayed with Kira until I was 16, 17. I was and right at the end of that time, I was in early productions with the pre-professional WA Ballet Company, but Kira Buslov, Gundi Sobkowiak, Kirill Vazogosky, these people who I actually wrote about in my master's thesis were extraordinary and characterful and character-making. And I really have felt that their influence on my artistic development is major. They were powerful women. Kira was a man, but Kira was Russian, from white Russian parents, born in France, and Gundi Sobkowiak was Viennese, and these two women were so powerful and self-determining. Mm-hmm. Both of them taught till they were very, very old women.
Do you know, was there much of a Russian community at that time in Perth?
I have no idea.
But they certainly were dominating the ballet scene.
Well, I mean, there was also Lindley Wilson, who had the whole, she had the kind of, she bought the British, which was then the Royal Ballet School, the RAD model out. So she'd been preceded Kira's presence here in the early 50s, actually. So ballet had been around, I mean, probably since the 19th century. I'm sure, make that reference, but there were extraordinary people who came and toured Australia in the late 19th century. And Pavlova but Pavlova's influence is, can't be underestimated. So ballet was the preceding practice, really. And as you're pointing out, it's still often where young girls are drawn to. And, and there's a prolific or a proliferation of ballet schools around. Though increasingly contemporary dance is taught within those schools.
Yes, absolutely. That's been the girls' experience too.
Yeah.
So what was your transition to contemporary dance like? And was there a kind of a segue where both were in operation?
Yes. Well, there was a very interesting man called Robert Pommier, and he'd done some work with the Australian Ballet, and he was, I think, married to Kathleen Gorham, who was their principal dancer. And he and Sylvie Palvolgi, gee, I'm not doing too bad with my memory here. And they, I was the youngest person in the company when he did a season at His Majesty's. I think I was 16, and he invited me to perform. So that was fantastic. So there were these kind of little inserts of people doing interesting work and original choreography. And his choreography was certainly not ballet. It was contemporary ballet, maybe what people would say now. I mean, these terms get really kind of folded into each other. But there was also an Englishman who came and did a work. And then I probably didn't do the technique of contemporary dance. Or no, I didn't really, until I went to WAPA. And I studied with, first of all, Jean Talley and then Reyes de Lara. And they were my dominant sort of.
I'm right in thinking you were a parent by then.
Well and truly, I had my children in my 20s.
Yes.
I didn't dance for 20 years. For about a decade, really. Perhaps a bit less. When my youngest child was 4, I started to go to a sort of jazz contemporary class once a week, and that was. That was terrific. And I think I always wanted to. I don't think I had any idea what was happening, but in terms of where I could direct my passion, really.
I think I remember being awed by your parenting and dance education all at the same time.
Oh, wow.
As many of us did, of course, not with dance,
right.
Though.
Yeah.
So, but when do you think you embraced contemporary art as an independent practitioner to the exclusion and an almost rejection of ballet?
Well, that's quite interesting, really, because there was that 1983 I graduated, but in that final year, Barry Moreland from the Ballet Ballet Company invited me to be... and I was still a student, to be a guest artist in his production of Romeo and Juliet. And that was fantastic because that wasn't done in point shoes, that was done in soft shoes, which again is that crossing over. And probably some people who are listening to this may have seen that production. I think it was an extraordinary production of Romeo and Juliet. And at 2 years later, he asked me to play the role of Lady Capulet. And that was a fantastic experience. And I was working in a contemporary dance company, teaching at WAPA, and doing some really wild and weird stuff in contemporary dance with still moves, and then zipping across to the ballet company and being guest artist with Lady Capulet. But Barry's background for that role was Martha Graham, one of the great old dames of modern dance.
Okay.
I mean, these terms get, I don't want to be too, I'm not fussy about them, but that, you know, she was sort of 30s to the 50s or 60s. I mean, there's still a Martha Graham company, so there's no boundary, but modern rather than what followed, which has been called contemporary dance. And then really the work I've done is stepped into what we call postmodern dance, the dance of the everyday, sort of 70s and beyond. So that was very interesting. And you're quite right, there was a time when I, and as a young feminist, I kind of rejected the whole notion of point shoes and, you know, the corseting of the female body and the whole male gaze, really, of the female body.
Was that a personal journey or part of the politics of the day?
Oh, definitely the politics of the day, inside postmodern dance, most definitely.
Yeah.
The great Yvonne Rainer had a whole, well, I call it her manifesto. It's no to the gaze and no to seduction and just no. And it's a famous bit of her writing, and she was a very young dancer making work at Judson Church in New York. So there was a kind of I had I suppose I idealized those those artists, and I read a lot, and I watched a lot, and I listened a lot, and I didn't leave Perth very much. I was raising three children on my own for a period of time. I had a keen ear, and I've always loved literature, so I was reading and inquiring.
I think I'm right in saying that this reconfigured the relationship of audience to dancer and dancer to audience.
Yes, yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
In a sense that
I hope so.
yes. So it's readdressing the whole issue of desire and, as you say, the male gaze, etc., etc. So some of the people that you were working with as a contemporary dancer, you've mentioned a lot of people.
Yeah.
You come in a crowded room, Alice.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Later on, the people who you worked with as a postmodern dancer or dance artist, as you now describe your work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I didn't work directly with Yvonne Rainer, but I worked with Roseanne Spradlin in New York. I worked with and studied with Nancy Stark Smith and Lisa Nelson. Lisa Nelson came to Australia a couple of times, and many of us worked with her. And Lisa is the person who gave me a tiny bit of the first publication of the work of Body Mind Centering of Bonnie Bainbridge Cohen. But I just want to skip back a bit, because your question prior segues and overlaps here, which is that as an older dancer artist, I have this maybe more generous idea about, I don't any longer, well, approached with intelligence, and I know many companies in Europe are doing this. I don't know so much whether that's happening in Australia. It's not been my observation. But, for instance, if we take the classical ballet of Giselle, so many people listening to this are going to know, they've seen Giselle. So I played the mother of Giselle in the WO Ballet Company twice, actually. And once upon a time, I would have possibly seen that as a kind of, why do we need that? You know, that way we sort of almost threw the baby out with the bathwater.
Mm.
But I now see it quite differently, actually. It was a medieval story. It's a story of the peasant girl and the nobleman. It's about class, and it's about she's a little plaything. But she actually dies of a broken heart because she has a weak heart. But I think the story, it's a moral story. It's a moral
context.
And ethical story. And it's not just a sort of Swan Lake, you could say the same. It's a story of bewitchment and enchantment.
Mm. Multi-levelled work.
Multi-levelled. And I think that these works are being reinterpreted with this kind of, I think, a feminist lens, whether they're men choreographers or not. I think there's more complexity coming into the interpretations, and I somehow feel that's important.
Alice, you've mentioned body-mind centering, and we talk about you as a somatic therapist. Can you unpack those terms for people outside those fields?
Well, because the word somatic has become a bit too common in some ways, in my observation, when I was first qualified as a somatic practitioner. I'm not a somatic therapist. Most people align that with the psychotherapeutic model.
Mm-hmm.
My study was 4 years in Massachusetts, in the School for Body Mind Centering, and it was an enormous gift via the Australia Council. I got, I think I am the only dancer to receive that, you know, big independent grant to do this 4-year study, return every year for an entire summer. And it was intensive work. It's complex work. And I'm qualified as a somatic movement therapist and or educator. And I think I really quite like seeing myself as an educator, because that's been my one of the strengths of my creative life. And I have, there's the, being creative is therapeutic, say, you know, these definitions don't hold fast. But the word somatic, first soma comes into, a man called Thomas Hanna first introduced the notion of soma, the body. It's Greek, I believe it's Greek for body. So it's how we are experiencing our life through the body. And it's become, and I'm both delighted and have concerns about how it's become a kind of popular thing to say, people say, add the word somatic. But I wonder at the depth of their knowledge. And I guess my study was so intensive. I'd like to think that it was not just an add-on.
No.
That it's an in-depth study of the moving body.
Mm. Well, I know also from your teaching that you also have run classes focusing on particular body parts, like the kidneys or the lungs or the heart, to give us
systems of the body.
Systems of the body,
yeah,
to presumably to bring attention to those areas and to bring knowledge of those areas to movement itself.
Well, also to bring the person, if we're talking about me in a transmission, which you are, as me as an educator, it's not so much to impose my knowledge, but to, I actually really like to say I'm a guide with this work, because you know, you can't actually force anyone to change or have an experience. All you can do is guide them and invite. So I teach now people to teach this work.
Mm.
So it's a very fine collaboration, really, where the student needs to feel safe. And, of course, there's a lot of language around that in the current culture.
Yes.
But it's, first of all, meeting the person where they are. If we can meet the person where they are, not where we'd like them to be, but where they are, then we have somewhere to begin. That's the best.
Well, fortunately, I had experience of doing such a project with you, with a very unusual collaboration in the 90s with the Public Service Union.
Again, a once-off.
A once-off, but quite an extraordinary project, which involved, again, collaboration with local composers, Chris Farr, photographer, Ross Bolliter, I think.
No, Rob Muir.
Rob Muir was involved, Ross Bolliter in other projects, I think.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about what you were trying to do there? Because I participated in that project, and
you're the writer, Christine.
And have also been a public servant and somebody who sits in a chair and at a computer and the swivel chair, and all those things came into play in the classes and in the final performance. Would you like to talk about that, if you can recall some of the work that was done?
Yeah. Well, I could just almost bracket it by saying, you know, we were looking at the labour of the everyday.
Yes, that's right.
And in that labour there's movement. I mean, that is what we do, and we move in order to experience our life, actually. I'm just remembering being in the studio upstairs at Northbridge, and Ian, the head of the public
secretary
Ian,
yes,
coming
that's right.
every week for the 10-week program, as well as going out to Mirrabooka, as going down to
Quinana somewhere.
Not quite at Spearwood, was it Spearwood?
Yeah.
And giving these classes in spaces that were
lunchtime.
Things pushed the coffee breaks so that people could lie on the floor.
Yeah. And I actually caught up with the comments in preparation for talking to you. And one of the biggest things, the main thing was that they went away with a much greater perception of what was happening in their bodies during the day.
Yeah.
Whether it's the small ache in the back, the need to move,
their hands,
their awareness of being still, the dryness of the air, all that they were hyper aware of after that course, which was wonderful.
So there was that element to it, Christine, but if you remember, we also made a work, myself and the other woman I worked with, and I remember one of the bits of choreography I did of getting people on one side of the room, and I had a score, and one of the scores, and I still think it holds it holds even more so, that no matter what, in a consumerist focused world, when you focus on thinking you'll be happy if you buy that or achieve that.
Yes.
I had people in this eternal reach, so that they were reaching and falling and reaching and falling.
And rushing.
And rushing towards and collapsing.
Yes.
Well, I think you'd say that we're still in quite a bit of that as a...
Yes.
As a focus of happy, thinking that we'd be happy once we got that material good. And perhaps I was trying to... I mean, maybe it's aspirational, but it was also, I am an artist, so I want to bring people to a feeling of the poetic in life, that we need to be fed in all sorts of ways to have a rich life. And it's not the richness of things.
And I remember you incorporating speech into that, because one of the things that people do, particularly in offices when they brush past, is these little snippets of, the water cooler conversation or the corridor conversation, and I think people really became hyper aware of that and how their speech ran during the day.
Yeah.
So that was an important.
So can I just say what I think you're saying is that people became aware of the composition, because it's all about composition: sitting, standing, walking, rushing, speaking. Dialoguing.
Which was their life, basically.
Moving in and around desks.
Yes.
All we did was, in parts, amplify it. And
frame it. Actually.
And frame it. And that, for me, gives it a kind of, it gives it, I want to say beauty. I don't mean it has to be pretty, but there's a, I'm acknowledging that this is the shape of someone's lives, and this is how people spend their lives, and how do we value that?
It sort of becomes an artifact to actually look on, and consider.
Yes,
in a way. Yeah. So, 18th, 20th of January, you are leading up to what might be, maybe your last solo performance. I don't believe it for a minute, but. You are now, shall we say, both of us in our early 70s.
Yeah.
And this piece, which I was fortunate to watch in rehearsal, is called Terror. Would you like to tell us something about its development, Alice?
Yes, Terror. It emerged in 2020. I was in regional Victoria for the first year of COVID. We had a little bit more freedom than people in Melbourne, not a lot, but a little bit more. But I had my own studio, and I'd had this idea. I don't remember at this moment the origins, but I always wanted to work with paper, big pieces of brown paper. And all I could do was go to the local news agency. So I went and got this newspaper, not newspaper, brown paper. I glued it together on the studio floor, having no idea. But I think this what preceded that, and it's in my original journal writing, was the horrific fires on the east coast of Australia. And the impact of that, I mean, when I say that, my embodied somatic experience is kind of terror, T-E-R-R-O-R. And the loss was enormous. It is enormous. And at the same time, I was meeting with a group of extremely diverse people, from philosophers to archaeologists and anthropologists and artists, and myself, another dancer, a social scientist. And there was a beginning of a discussion about all sorts of changes that were being anticipated. And this was actually just before the fires. So it was like it preempted what was coming. And it was before the pandemic. It was before. So this work kind of originated in that. And then when the fires came, I got underneath this paper, and the affect on me and the effect that I could intuit was very profound, and I felt intensely excited and thought, I'm onto something. And I worked hard every day. I just kept making this thing on my own, as I do, and had, when I was allowed to, one fantastic dance scholar and another very experienced dance artist who'd been my student at WAPA, Pia Leach, and she's coming over to be here as my producer in the last week of the work. Siobhan Murphy, the scholar, said, Alice, this is a longer work. And I got a very profound challenge by that. Not a 20-minute work. This is something I want to stay with. I want to be inside this with you. So I just kept plugging away at it, really. And at a different period in my life, I had an injury, a very intense injury in my left knee, and I was in a lot of pain, so everything stopped. And then I had made this enormous life decision to move to Perth.
Yes.
Return. I call it return, not move back. It's too linear. I'm returned. I'm around. Come around.
Yeah.
And I will tell you really that
you've been on a circular journey.
Yeah, the big story there is I feel like I've come back to my country and everything about it. Smells right, sounds right, feels right. And I really never thought I would come back. I had a very rich student population, a really rich professional career, and
it may be that your thoughts being occupied so much by the environment and by climate change at the moment have informed your return. Given that you were in the inner city for a while, both in Sydney and in Melbourne, now you are much more embraced by the natural environment here in Perth.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. But my studio in regional Victoria was surrounded by bush.
True.
And I think I've got a part of me that always seeks the natural world. But I agree. The pull of the natural world is big. It's big here. And to be between the river and the ocean for me felt like a gift. A gift.
So regardless of whether this does end up being your last solo performance, because I know you're planning other performances with other people.
Am I?
Yes, you are. You dropped that. You dropped that the other day. So what does it feel like to be, as a dancer, reaching your 70s with all the challenges that you've already told us about? How does it feel as you go into your next phase? Do you anticipate what the future might look like? I know you're going to continue to teach, which I'm very pleased to hear, because you are a fabulous teacher.
Thank you. Well, the richness of teaching is, I felt like I had to learn to be a really good teacher, and that in itself is a practice. And I think with COVID, it brought me into another world, as it did many people, into the world of Zoom. And I never, never would have thought I could transmit this embodied material through an internet screen. And I had students literally begging me to do something.
Because of COVID.
Yeah. And when one of them said, and she's a wonderful mover, but she's also got a fabulous voice, and she said, I've become very skillful, I'll give you online teaching. So how could I resist? You know, this is what my life of teaching has done. You know, generations of students. I'm now teaching people who are not quite the children of the people, but, you know, my students have gone from being 18 to 50. And one of them is Michelle Hovain. She's the artistic director, one of the co-artistic directors of Sensorium Theatre. She lives in Fremantle. She's contributed enormously to the culture of Perth, but Western Australia, and therefore, you know, Australia-wide. And they've taken their work to the Lincoln Centre in New York and been complimented on their methodology, which is the work she studied with me. Mm-hmm. So there's been a commitment as a company to they work with children with profound and complex disabilities. And where do we start? We start with the body.
Mm-hmm.
And she's been working with me now, how would you say, 30 years. I mean, and there are many students. My director, Nikki Hayward, is coming, and she's done 20-odd years of study with me, and now she's my collaborator.
Fantastic. Yeah. Fantastic. So teaching and performing, equal weight in your life, or?
Yeah, I realise I answered your teaching part of that. You know, I think when my knee was, I mean, I was in acute pain 24 hours a day, it was such a shock because I've been very fortunate with my body. And I guess that made me realise, no, the 70s are not the 60s. It's the 60s and not the 50s. This is a whole other agenda here. And maybe this is my last ability. But as you know, I'm working every day in the studio and I'm not in pain and my body's doing very well. And I'd love to keep it like this. Well, I just think in lots of ways I feel like I'm doing my best work. This is my best work. And what a great loss it is culturally if people stop often with their most intellectual and creative realizations. And I feel like why not keep going? I was watching who's that fantastic English actor? She's in her 90s. She lives alone. Oh, goodness me.
Australian? English?
No. British.
Oh, Maggie Fee?
Not Maggie. That's who was coming up. She also did the James Bond movies. Very famous.
Judy Dench.
And she said, oh, let it continue. Please bring it on. So how about I said it?
I think that's a very good phrase, but I'm going to ask you one more question because we do have time.
Great.
Contemporary dance, as the big broad field term used by the outsider, have there been losses along the way, do you think, in terms of things that might have been continued? Has it been a trajectory of progress? What is your view of the field itself? Is that too difficult to answer? Do you think?
No, that's not difficult. It's more complex, and I don't want to
including access to funding, perhaps, in that answer.
Yeah, I'm not. And there is, I think what you could say is it's become more complex. So there are more fields. The young woman Emma Fishwick, who did my filming. Extraordinary, wonderful young woman to work with, finishing her PhD. She's using film and lots of other things, she tells me, as well as choreography. And I think there are more branches into this realm of what we might call contemporary dance. And so you've got, and along with that is very difficult funding. When I rang, when I received the grant from the Department of Local Government, Sports, Culture and the Arts, I think I've got that right, Christine. She said, congratulations, goodness me, you must have written a good grant. It's very difficult to get, there's only 5%. I was stunned, actually, and I mean, I knew it was tough.
Only 5% of applications. Or 5%,
5% of applications.
Right.
Were funded.
Only 5% funded.
Only 5%. That's what she said to me on the phone.
Right.
So it's a wing and a prayer, really, but I had spent time writing as well as I could and getting the feedback I needed to get the grant. But other people could work just as hard and not get the money. But people are finding ways, and I'm not going to make this romantic. I think there are losses in terms of interrogating work at a depth for duration. I've got a 6-week grant, but I haven't spent 6 weeks on this. I've just told you I've spent 2.5 to 3 years on it.
That's right.
And that's self-funded, you could say.
Yes.
I mean, it is self-funded. I got a grant in Victoria for my producer, Veronica Bolzen, who's been fantastic. But there are, so that there's wonderful young dancers who become filmmakers, so they take that into their making of film, and there are dancers that do, you know, very different solo work and tour. I'm finding here touring all over the state, working with Indigenous people with a great deal of integrity. So I don't think you get away with it if you haven't. I hope you don't.
So one of the costs, literal costs,
yes,
has been financial.
Sure, absolutely.
as we sit here in your little lovely one-bedroom flat. Do you think young people are exploring other means to use dance as a way of addressing the problem of financial insecurity? Is that one of the things that's now possible?
I think you need to repeat that. Are they using dance to...
Well, working in other fields.
Well, artists in this country,
you have to diversify.
You have to have another gig. You might have a part-time lecturing job or be working as at the university. Pia Leach is retraining as an osteopath. But in another couple of years, you watch, she'll be dancing and making again.
Yes, it's a fallback.
But it doesn't mean that's not a happy transition. It's full of grief. It's full of loss.
Mm.
It's full of major suffering, actually. I don't want to romanticize that. And I've been reading about Patrick White suffered a great deal with every book he wrote. So I think suffering is an aspect of our hopefully becoming more human. But I think to be an artist in Australia, in this very wealthy country, is not easy, actually, unless you're inside a company. And then as brilliant as you might be, there's very little opportunity for you to make original work and to explore your originality. That leap requires, it's a dangerous leap into something else.
I think we've talked before about how the performance happens on the hopefully the lovely wooden floors of a building, and then the performance sort of dissipates. It goes in people's heads and it's momentary. But of course now many performances are recorded and...
Yep.
I would like to think Terra. Tell us what your plans are for Terra.
Well,
for many people to see it, rather than a few that can get there to Janet Holmes Court Gallery, 18th to the 20th of January.
Yes. Well, it's not in the grant. I'd have to get more funding. A certain amount, small amount, was there for documentation, which is not necessarily... Documentation can just be a run of performance, which is not necessarily going to give your audience an interesting...
That's just a proof that you actually did what they...
Well, no, it's also for you as an artist to have a record. But I happened to have this... Well, I couldn't get somebody here at the time. It's the Festival of Perth coming up. Mm. I don't know people. I've had to really establish my contacts again.
Yes.
So in a kind of moment of desperation, I rang the very wonderful young woman in Melbourne, Kobe Orger, who filmed other work of mine, and she just leapt at it. And so I am contributing part of my own money to bring her over. And together we're hoping to get really good footage, both in the gallery and also outside in the bush somewhere.
Mm.
And she's got a very inspirational idea.
She's wanted to do something like this with me for a long time. I feel ready for it, actually. Mm. And it might take a year to edit it, but she's got a beautiful idea about how to put it together. I'm not going to tell you the rest. It's a bit of a secret.
Sure.
Yes. Because there are going to be there are people that obviously can't fly here from Melbourne and Sydney and who would love to see it. So I'd really very much like to have a decent product that I could.
Well, I'd love to see more Australian artists, composers, dancers on ABC and SBS, and measurable stations. Wouldn't that be good?
Absolutely.
On that little wish list, we might leave the interview. Thank you very much, Alice, for talking to me today.
Thank you, Kristen. It's been delightful.